From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet artist Andre Serrano. His photograph of a crucifix immersed in urine was one of the artworks that provoked Jesse Helms' crusade against federal funding of controversial art. Serrano's current gallery show features photographs of the dead taken at a morgue. And how has rock music changed in the past decade? Rock historian Ed Ward plays us the hits of 1983. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton received some well-placed support for his economic plan today. Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan called it a serious proposal for tackling the nation's deficit. NPR's John Idstey reports.
The Federal Reserve Chairman commended the president for putting a plan for deficit reduction on the table with what he called plausible economic assumptions and detailed program-by-program recommendations. Mr. Greenspan did say he believes spending cuts are the best way to reduce deficits. The president's plan has some spending reductions, but it leans heavily on tax increases to bring the deficit down. The Fed chairman warned that the deficit is a corrosive force, undermining the vitality of the free market system. He said if the Congress and president fail to deal with it now, cutting it in the future will be far more difficult. Greenspan also gave the Federal Reserve's economic forecast for 1993. He said the economy is likely to grow at a moderate rate of just over 3%. He predicted unemployment would fall to just under 7%. And he said inflation should run just above 2.5%. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
White House Budget Director Leon Panetta says it's too early to say, but he believes that higher taxes on alcohol and cigarettes will most likely be used to pay for the president's health care reform program. Yesterday, Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen said that higher so-called sin taxes were under consideration to pay for a national health plan, but he did not say if he thought this would be necessary. These taxes were not among those proposed by the president this week. Mr. Clinton wants to change the nation's $800 billion a year medical system in hopes of driving down expenses that are now rising at several times the rate of inflation. At the same time, the president wants a system that will extend coverage to the 35 million people in the country who now have no health insurance. Thousands of people in Dutchess County, New York, lined a motorcade route today, standing in sub-freezing temperatures in order to see the president. Gene Brian Johnson of member station WNYC reports from Hyde Park, New York.
The political scene here in Hyde Park is dominated by Republicans. President Clinton received less than 25% of the vote during the election, but more than 500 mostly Clinton supporters crowded into the Haviland Middle School auditorium to hear the president sell his economic plan. He ridiculed critics who accused him of reneging on his campaign promise not to raise middle-class taxes, saying that after just 4 weeks in office, he's identified more than 150 areas where he can cut spending, eliminating funding for the Bicentennial Commission, for instance. The president challenged his critics, many who've been in Washington much longer than he, to make specific recommendations for more cuts. For National Public Radio, this is Gene Brian Johnson in Hyde Park.
This is NPR News. A federal court in Miami has ordered a suspected hijacker to jail without bond. 24-year-old Woody Edouard is charged with air piracy in connection with the hijacking in Haiti yesterday of a plane owned by a missionary group in Florida. Officials say the suspect has told them that he was desperate to leave his country. A woman was taken hostage yesterday in northern Haiti before the plane with 13 people on board was forced to fly to Miami. There were no injuries. Secretary of State Warren Christopher is now in Jordan after meeting in Cairo with Egyptian officials, including Egyptian President Mubarak. The secretary reportedly gained Egyptian support for resuming Middle Eastern peace talks after saying that he will urge Israeli officials to speed up case studies of more than 400 Palestinians expelled to southern Lebanon late last year. Lori Neff reports from Cairo.
Following talks with Secretary Christopher, President Mubarak said he has accepted an invitation to go to Washington in April to discuss the Middle East peace talks. Mubarak, however, says he and Christopher haven't come up with a new agenda for the Palestinians' return. He says, in his words, it will take some time. Egypt says Israel's offer to repatriate 100 Palestinians now and the rest by the end of the year isn't enough to convince Arabs to resume negotiations with Israel. Cairo reportedly had wanted to convince Christopher to press Israel to offer more, perhaps a definite timetable for all the Palestinians' return. For National Public Radio, I'm Laurie Neff in Cairo.
UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali has ordered suspended aid shipments in Bosnia resumed as quickly as possible. This move comes after the UN's top relief official suspended aid operations, charging that food was being used as a political weapon in Bosnia. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council has given peacekeepers in Croatia the right to use force if necessary in order to defend themselves. I'm Ann Taylor, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Lots of people who have never even seen Andre Serrano's work have an opinion about it. Because in 1989, his work, along with the work of Robert Mapplethorpe, was at the center of the debate over federal funding of controversial art. Jesse Helms used Serrano's photograph, Piss Christ, as one of the primary examples of the blasphemous, worthless art the NEA should be prohibited from funding. The photograph shows Jesus on the cross through a yellow haze against a blood-colored background. As several critics have pointed out, if it weren't for the title, you would think the image was reverential and have no idea that it was a crucifix immersed in urine. Much of Serrano's work deals with taboos. His current show at the Paula Cooper Gallery in New York features a series of photographs of bodies taken at a morgue. The New Yorker magazine described these pictures as haunting and moral, having a humanity and grandeur which one expects to see in the paintings of El Greco or Francis Bacon. We want to advise you that we will be discussing subject matter that some listeners might find offensive or disturbing. Andre Serrano told me why he did a series of photos from a morgue.
Most artists, if they're interested in life, and I assume they are also interested in death. To me, it's not an extraordinary thought to want to portray death. A lot of painters have done it throughout history, you know. So, I mean, for me, the question is it always takes me aback, and I don't quite know how to answer it, except to say that, I think everyone is concerned with issues of mortality.
How did you find a morgue that let you take the photographs?
Well, it wasn't easy, but it wasn't hard once I found it, and I think I was just extraordinarily lucky through contacts to find that morgue.
Are you not supposed to say who they were or how you got them?
No, I don't say.
Because they knew it would be controversial that they let you in?
Well, I don't want to draw attention to the fact that, to this specific locale. To me, it's not important.
What were the ground rules for you? Did the people at the morgue say you can do this, but you can't do that?
They told me if a body has not been autopsied and it's a matter of police investigation, then don't touch anything. If there is no autopsy to be done or after the autopsy, you can touch anything you want. Just make sure you wear two pairs of gloves.
So you could arrange the body if you wanted to?
Yeah, but I rarely did that. I mean, the only thing that I really did was I covered up a couple of faces with a blindfold.
Yeah, I was wondering why you did that. And both of those faces, I think, that you covered up were pneumonia victims.
They happened to be pneumonia victims. They were HIV positive. It was actually AIDS, but it was pneumonia that they died of, yes. One woman, I suppose I'm not sure how she got the disease, but I know the man was got it through a blood transfusion.
So why did you cover up the eyes on both of those faces?
Because I thought they would be identifiable without the blindfold.
Oh, I see. Okay, so, I see. What was your process of approaching each body? Were they kind of zipped up in body bags or before?
Sometimes they would come in while I was working there. And, I think as of the second day, I knew more or less what direction I wanted to go in. And that's when I started to use a black backdrop. And my own flash equipment, of course.
Maybe you could describe what your approach was to taking the pictures.
Well, basically, I'm faced with the, formal decision of having to make these people look different when they're essentially all in the same position, lying on their backs. So I had to find for myself new ways of photographing them.
What ways did you try?
Well, initially, we'd photograph them pretty much mid-range. That is to say, get the entire, if not the entire body, I would get torsos and large areas of the body into the framing of the picture. Eventually, I decided to focus in on details, and so they became very much close-ups.
What surprised you about your emotional response to viewing dead people?
I suppose what surprised me was the fact that I was fairly cool about it. I remember when I first got there, the pathologist in charge of the morgue, who gave me permission to photograph, asked me if I had ever seen dead bodies before, and I said no, never. And he said that he warned me. He said some people can take and some can't. And so we went into the morgue, and as soon as I walked in through the door, I saw that there was a child on the autopsy table. She was about 7 or 8 years old, and she had died of chicken pox. And no sooner did I walk in than a doctor took a scalpel, and he opened her from the groin area right up to the neck. And all of a sudden, they just start taking her organs out. And it was very strange. One minute the child was, a human being with an identity, and the next minute she's nothing but me. But once I realized that I could take that, I knew I could take anything, and I just got to work.
One of the many interesting things about your series of photographs is that, this kind of art lets us see things that we would never see, and it lets us stare at things that it would be really socially unacceptable or impossible to stare at.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, the morgue is, and the idea of death is pretty taboo in many ways, even though we're exposed to it constantly on TV and in other ways. But the morgue itself is a pretty secret arena that very few people enter. And one thing that I notice about this show is, no matter how, and it has been strong for certain people, no matter how violent the reaction, although I think that's the exception to the rule, people are drawn to it and compelled to stay and stare.
Did you ever feel that it was wrong for you to stare, or that it was disrespectful to the dead to take their pictures?
Not at all. As an artist, it's a very difficult thing for me to say, that an idea should not be developed for moral reasons. There are very few things that I can think of, and I can't think of any right now, that I could say that I would say, no, I have to draw the line and stop here.
When I walked into the Paula Cooper Gallery, the first photograph of yours that I saw on the wall was called Hacked to Death. And this photograph is basically one quarter of a person's face, and the eye is at the center of the photograph. The skin is bruised. There's pools of blood that have formed in the recesses of the face. The eye is open, and the eye is reflecting light, but the eye does look dead. Tell me about taking this picture.
He was killed by his wife with a large kitchen knife. She stabbed him about 15 times. And, although I didn't think of it, someone has, said that it reminded me of that, reminded them of that scene in Andalusian Dog, Luis Buñuel's first movie, with the close-up of the eye.
That's the movie in which there's a razor blade that slits an eye open.
Exactly. And when that movie was first shown in the late 20s or 30s, I believe it caused a riot at the movie house.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel queasy or upset taking this one?
Not particularly, no, although he was a mess, I just think that for myself and the people who work there, there has to be some sort of emotional detachment to be able to do the work that you do. People ask me if I ever got upset, and I must say I never got upset about what I was doing. But I do remember at the time that I was going through my own personal changes and getting upset about other things in my life, having nothing to do with the morgue. And now when I think of it, it maybe was some sort of displacement. I know I couldn't afford to let anything come between me and the work I was doing. And so I didn't attribute my, my disturbances, emotional disturbances, to what I was doing.
In this photograph, Hacked to Death, how did you determine which part of the body or the face you wanted to focus on, how you wanted to frame it, what you wanted the photograph to say, basically?
Well, I did frame two different versions of it. And the second version, which I like a lot, but I didn't have room to show it at Paula Cooper Gallery, it essentially is a groin shot He had white underwear, except he's so bloody that it's almost all red. And, that was another shot that I concentrated on. At that point, when I was photographing that body, you know, I had come to the conclusion that details could tell me more or could be a lot stronger than whole areas. And so I was narrowing in on specific areas.
I guess what I reacted to most in that photo was the eye. We convey who we are so much with our eyes. Our eyes have so much personality. Our eyes register confusion or recognition. And I just found it very interesting to stare into this dead eye.
Mm. You know, to me, yeah, and as you say, it's a dead, lifeless eye, but it's still engaging in some way. And I think that, you know, sometimes I do portraits where I like to engage the sitter with the viewer through the camera, you know? And, that's essentially what happens with that man.
You have a photograph called Fatal Meningitis, and basically it's a photograph of two baby feet, and right above the ankles are sock marks, you know, the kind of like elastic sock marks that you get at the top of where the socks were on your legs. And I was wondering, like, how long this baby had been dead when you took the photograph, and how long sock marks like that stay on a body?
I think that baby was, had been in the morgue a relatively short time, a matter of hours, and those socks had been removed, perhaps a few, half an hour before I took the picture.
Do those sock marks interest you?
You know, a lot of times when I'm shooting, I'm under tight circumstances where I have to do my work very quickly, and so I don't take notice of certain details. A lot of times I familiarize myself with my subjects after I take the picture through the work, and I didn't see those marks at the time until after I finished the photograph.
You have a photograph in your show of a rat poison suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second photo, in Rat Poison Suicide 2, there's a foot protruding from a white body bag, and there's an open slit or wound on the foot. And as I walked through the gallery, I noticed that there were a couple of other bodies that had the same kind of wound. And I really couldn't tell whether this was a kind of wound that came after death or whether several of the bodies you photographed had the same wounds.
Yeah. Now, it was explained to me that those surgical incisions that the doctors make to determine whether or not there's a bruise underneath the skin, because bruises take a few hours, sometimes even longer, to appear on the surface of the skin. And so they make those cuts to see if there's damaged tissue underneath there.
Well, I'll tell you, when I saw those wounds, they looked kind of familiar to me, and they reminded me in a way of certain wounds that I've seen in paintings of Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. For me also, it reminds me of the stigmata. And that's why I think that picture in particular assumes a religious persona because of that.
That also made me think about how a lot of biblical imagery is of the dead. Jesus, saints, martyrs?
Yeah, absolutely. I have been drawn to religious themes in the past, and even though this work is not overtly spiritual or religious in nature, I think that you're right, there's a reference to painting, specifically religious painting sometimes.
Religious imagery figures into a lot of your work, including your most famous piece, Piss Christ, which we'll talk about in a little while, but I'm wondering if you grew up in a religious house.
Basically, my mother was Catholic, but she was the sort of woman who was always late, and we would get to Mass about 10 minutes before it ended.
Was that a relief to you, or were you sorry you missed it?
And to her, too, probably.
Uh-huh. So, I think your mother was African-Cuban, and your father was from Honduras?
Yes.
So they were Catholic?
They were, actually, but I don't know too much about what my father's religion was because I didn't spend much time with him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what kind of religious imagery did you see when you were growing up?
Except for it's funny because we didn't have any crucifixes at home. She thought they were kind of morbid, but there was a picture of Jesus, a small picture of Sacred Heart. But the most religious images that I saw were at the Metropolitan Museum of Art when I was about 12 years old and started to go there by myself. That was my first influence, really, my first, endeavor into art.
My guest is artist Andre Serrano. In 1989, his work was at the center of the controversy over public funding of the arts. His show of photos from the morgue closes tomorrow at the Paula Cooper Gallery in New York. More after we take a break. This is Fresh Air. Artist Andre Serrano is my guest. Well, let me ask you about Piss Christ, which is the very controversial work that that you made and that in 1989 helped create that whole controversy about federal funding of controversial art. For our listeners who have only heard about this piece but have never seen it, would you describe Piss Christ?
Basically, it's a crucifix bathed in a murky yellow light, and it's a very mysterious image. I think, as many people have pointed out, without the title, it would have been seen as a very reverential treatment of the crucifix, and you know, fit to hang in a church, probably.
This was a photograph.
Yes.
But the crucifix was actually immersed in urine.
Yes.
Yours.
Yes.
What was the idea behind the piece?
Well, basically, you know, I had been doing religious imagery before Piss Christ, and then I realized that I was concentrating a lot on photographing dead animals and using a lot of blood in my work, and so I decided to reduce and simplify my imagery, and I did that by concentrating on using only blood and milk. And at some point, you know, I felt like I had to add piss to my palette, otherwise I'd just be making, you know, red and white pictures forever. So, you know, Piss Christ is essentially, you know, initially the fluid pictures were about abstraction, and eventually when I decided to refer back to some sort of representation, Piss Christ was, a very natural image for me to make, because it was a way of combining two different directions in my work in one image.
The body fluid direction and the religious imagery direction?
Yes.
Now, when you put those two together, a lot of people see it as blasphemous.
Well, you know, I never saw it that way. And I remember when I first showed the work in New York that this woman, she was married to a reverend. She said to me, you know, when it comes to religion, my husband and I don't agree about anything, but we were both very moved by your picture. And, you know, that essentially was the reaction at first. No one, you know, paid much mind to Piss Christ, except after, you know, the American Family Association got into the picture more than 2 years after the picture was first made.
What were you saying about religion in that piece?
Well, I would say that you know, Piss Christ is probably a reflection of my own ambivalent feelings about my Catholic upbringing. Aside from that, there's nothing specific. You know, I mean, you know, all sorts of, you know, claims have been made for that piece. And I remember at the time that I was embroiled in the controversy, the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art, which was the sponsor of that very controversial grant and art show, said to me, you know, the NEA is breathing down our necks for an explanation of Piss Christ, and, you know, can we say it's a, you know, protest against the commercialization of religion and you know, religious values? And I said, you know, well, that's not language that I would use, but, you know, if you want to say that's fine. At this point in my life, you know, I, you know, first of all, I'm sort of tired of Piss Christ. And also, I feel like the less said about the picture, the better, because I don't feel the need to defend it.
How did you choose which crucifix to use?
By that point, I had a large collection of crucifixes, which I still have. And so, you know, I just went in the room and chose one.
What was it like for you to be at the center of a national controversy, to have your art addressed on the Senate floor?
It was very strange. I mean, at first I couldn't believe it when they first told me that this was going on, that, you know, thousands of people, you know, at the request of the American Family Association, were sending in protest letters to Congress. And then I saw myself being denounced, you know, on TV and in the congressional record by all these people who never could spell my name right. I remember in one entry in the congressional record in May of 1989, I think three or four senators referred to me, and they all remarkably spelled my name differently and all wrong.
How politicized had you been about the arts, First Amendment issues, funding of the arts?
Not very. And I still, I'm not very politicized as far as that's concerned. I remember, you know, after, you know, during and after the controversy, people would ask me to come lecture on censorship, you know. And I always declined to do that. I declined to be on panels. You know, I feel I will lecture, you know, on my work, but I'm not, you know, I'm not a crusader of any sort, you know.
Jesse Helms led the crusade against your work and against federal funding of controversial art. He said that he had never met you, but he was sure you were not an artist, you were a jerk. Have you met him since he said that?
No, but I came close. One time I was in Atlanta, and he was due to speak at a Baptist church down there. And then, but, you know, all these artists mounted a protest the morning that he was supposed to appear. And so they sent word that he couldn't make it because the budget was out of control and he had to stay in Washington or something. And so he never came, but I had actually bought my ticket to see him.
What most angered you and what did you find most absurd or amusing about how political people discussed your art?
I don't know. I think the most remarkable thing for me was, he made it seem like he said something about that I was taunting the American public or the American people. And I mean, that was, to me, a remarkable image in my head, like I was standing there single-handedly taunting the American public, you know. It was incredible. I must say, though, it hurt me a lot, you know. I mean, even though everyone thinks Jesse Helms is a jerk, you know. I mean, I took it personal.
Why did you take it personally?
I don't know. He was saying nasty things about me.
Was that the first time that that had happened to you, that somebody was saying nasty things about you because of your art?
Absolutely.
Do you think that the controversy about Piss Christ ended up bringing you a larger audience that you had before? I mean, let's face it, at most galleries, the people who show up are people who are already in or interested in the art world. And once this became a national issue, I imagine a lot of curious people who don't usually go to galleries showed up to see your work.
No question about it. And for me, I mean, you know, the collectors also came in droves, and that was nice, too. But for me, it's most refreshing and satisfying when I get people, people who don't normally go to art shows, who go to my shows. I mean, at Paula Cooper Gallery, they've had, many, many calls from people asking, how much does it cost to get in? And these are obviously not your usual art clientele and public, but they come to the show.
Jesse Helms wanted to hurt art like yours. Do you think he inadvertently helped you a lot?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I helped him in some ways, and he helped me. You know, he got reelected, and, I became who I am.
Some people say that it's just impossible to shock audiences anymore with art. Now, a lot of people claimed to be shocked by some of your art. Are you interested in shocking people?
No, and I think the most provocative art is art that does not try to be provocative. I think when you try to shock, it usually doesn't work, It's when you're not trying that it may happen.
And yet you're very interested in taboos, taking pictures of dead animals, taking pictures of dead people in the morgue.
I am, yes.
So why are you interested in taboos?
Why not? I think someone has to do the work that I do, and I think by examining these taboos, eventually they become less of a taboo. During Victorian times, taking pictures of dead people was not a taboo. People would take the photographs of their loved ones in their arms sometimes who were deceased. And the idea of death was not threatening to most people. And I think, at some point in the future, maybe death won't be such a taboo anymore either.
Artist Andre Serrano, his show of photographs from the morgue closes tomorrow at the Paula Cooper Gallery in Manhattan. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Andre Serrano will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our conversation with artist Andre Serrano. We'll discuss a turning point in his life that informs his work and led to subjects that some find socially unacceptable. Also, rock historian Ed Ward surveys what was popular 10 years ago. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Michael Leland. President Clinton and his subordinates continued their selling of the president's economic program today. For the second straight day, Budget Director Leon Panetta appeared before a congressional committee. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
This time it was the Senate Budget Committee that listened as Panetta outlined some of the key points and defended the structure of the plan. Again, Republicans attacked it for being too heavy on taxes and too light on spending cuts. And again, Panetta challenged the GOP lawmakers to come up with their own cuts. He also argued against a proposal from Republicans to cap spending for entitlements such as Medicaid. Panetta said a cap would mean sharp cuts in other programs.
You want to cut veterans programs 23%? Do you want to cut agriculture programs 23%? Do you want to cut other retirement programs, civil service, military retirement programs 23%?
Panetta also said taxes on alcohol and tobacco would probably be necessary to pay for the administration's planned health care reforms. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan has praised the Clinton economic plan and tried to reassure lawmakers today he would use monetary policy if necessary to offset any economic harm from spending cuts and tax increases. His comments are seen as an implicit message the Fed would cut short-term interest rates to offset any economic squeeze resulting from the plan. President Clinton continued boosting his plan before the American people, stopping in Ohio and New York. The president promised he would not raise taxes unless Congress made spending cuts. The Clinton administration wants to cancel plans to build a large U.S. government radio transmitter in Israel. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The facility was designed to broadcast Voice of America programs in several languages to Eastern Europe and Central Asia. The president's economic plan, announced on Wednesday, cancels funding for the project. Environmental groups in Israel are pleased. They warned that the facility would be an eyesore in the desert where it was to be built and would disorient migratory birds. On the other hand, the project would have created an estimated 600 jobs in Israel, where unemployment is high. The Clinton administration wants to use $30 million of the money saved by canceling the transmitter to establish a radio-free Asia service. And another U.S. transmitter planned for Kuwait will go forward under the Clinton plan. All this is subject to congressional approval. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
A radical Palestinian leader says Palestinians worldwide should vote on whether the Middle East peace process should continue. Nayef Hawatma of the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine made his call at a rally in Damascus. The rally coincides with Secretary of State Christopher's visit to the region to try to restart the negotiations. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed higher today, gaining nearly 20 points to close at 3322.18. This is NPR News. A group of Nobel laureates visiting Thailand today called on the UN to suspend Burma from the organization because of alleged human rights abuses. They also want fellow laureate Aung San Suu Kyi, who has been under house arrest for more than 3 years, to be released. Mary Kay Magstead reports from Hong Kong.
The Nobel laureates' recommendations went even further than expected. Besides calling for economic and arms embargoes against the Burmese junta, they also said that Burma's UN membership should be suspended until the junta lets the elected pro-democracy government take power. The laureate said the junta should also immediately release 1991 Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi. Junta leaders have already condemned the Nobel laureate's visit, saying they are meddling in Burma's internal affairs. But they will likely be paying attention next week when the laureates travel to Geneva to present their case to the UN Human Rights Commission. At a time when the junta has been trying to improve its international image, it doesn't want to become any more of a pariah than it already is. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Bangkok.
The UN Security Council will adopt a resolution Monday on setting up a tribunal for war crimes committed in the former Yugoslavia. Final details of the draft have been worked out by the United States, China, France, Britain, and Russia. It will ask Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali to outline within 60 days proposals on how the tribunal would be formed and how it would operate. A second resolution would be needed to actually create the tribunal. Air pollution in Mexico City today soared to more than twice the level considered unhealthy, causing dizziness, burning eyes, and headaches in many people. Mexican government officials say some industries have ignored their demand to reduce output. One government official says between 20 and 40 companies a day are ignoring the cutback orders. This is National Public Radio News.
This is Fresh Air. We're back with artist Andre Serrano. In 1989, his art was at the center of the debate over public funding of controversial art. Some people have found his new show disturbing. Many find it very moving and thought-provoking. The show features his photographs of dead bodies taken at a morgue. In a little while, we'll discuss a turning point in Serrano's life that led him toward art about taboos. First, let's hear about his 1990 series of photographs of homeless people called Nomads. He took their portraits in a makeshift studio he set up in a New York subway station. He told me about the inspiration behind the series.
I was inspired by Edward Curtis's portraits of the American Indians at the turn of the century. And Curtis felt he was photographing a vanishing race. And some people, you know, to this day have a problem with Curtis's images because they feel he used his models and gave them robes and props that they didn't ordinarily have. But I defend his work because I remember growing up in the 50s when the only other images that I ever saw of the American Indian was his savages on television. So I much prefer Curtis's heroic portraits.
So did you try to pose homeless people in a heroic way?
I probably did, you know. And someone once said to me, oh, you've given these people so much dignity. And I answered, you know, I've not given these people any dignity that they didn't already have. I just brought it out.
So what kind of studio did you set up in the subway? What was it like?
It was a gray background and my flash equipment and a stool and a tripod and camera.
Did any police ever try to stop you? It's against the law to do nearly anything on a subway platform.
Absolutely. And the police were much better than the transit authority inspectors who, you know, would literally, you know, block my camera and threaten me. The police on occasion would say, okay, finish up and then you have to go, and they were very nice.
You paid each person who sat for you. How much did you pay them?
I paid them $10 for about 15 minutes work. And I know people think, oh, $10 doesn't sound like much, but I would photograph about 7 or 8 people a night. I would pay the two friends who helped me about $50. So every time I went out, it cost me about $140, maybe $150. And I went out maybe 20 or 30 times. So I stopped doing the work when I couldn't afford to do it anymore.
Do you know, were you able to ever show the photos to people who you photograph? Were you able to find them afterwards? Did you try?
At some point, three of the people that I photographed actually found, you know, heard about the show and went to see it. And, you know, I've been told that they were very pleased with their portraits. Not so long ago, just before Christmas, someone called me up on my machine at home and left a message saying, my name is Renee, and, you know, you took my picture about 2 years ago, and it was in Mirabella, and, you know, people all over saw it, and I wanted to talk to you, maybe get a small print or something. So, you know, we got together, and, yeah, Renee said he was at a very low point in his life at that point. He had been to college, and then people start to see his picture, and they call his mother's house, and, you know, people as far away as Switzerland called his mother, and they want to know, What is happening with Renee? And somehow Renee, it was a turning point in his life, and he started to get himself together. And he's actually working right now as as a counselor for a homeless project in the Port Authority. And he has a nice little office, and I gave him a print to hang up.
That's interesting. Now, I know that you stopped making art for about 7 years, during which period you were doing a lot of drugs. I know that period of your life ended about 12 years ago, from what I've read. I couldn't help but wonder if you were ever homeless during that period.
I was never homeless, but I used to, you know, spend a lot of time on the streets, you know. And, you know, because when you do drugs, you just spend a lot of time out there. So, you know, for me, there was not that comfortable distance, say, if I was a white person photographing homeless people, you know. I mean, I often walk down the street and see people or see people, see people that remind me of people that I used to hang out with, or sometimes even on an occasion I see people that I do know from way back then, and I often wonder why them and why not me, you know.
Did that have something to do with your interest in doing this series?
Absolutely, yeah.
So how did you end that period of your life of doing drugs?
Well, basically, when I turned 28, I felt that, I had gone to art school when I was much younger, when I was 17, 18, and I felt that I always knew that I was going to be an artist. And at the age of 28, I just felt myself, I felt my biological clock telling me that if I didn't stop doing drugs, soon I would not ever become the artist that I felt I was. And so I immediately stopped, And getting to the point where I weaned myself completely off drugs was not easy. But once I got there, I never looked back,
Now, how did your art change when you started making it again?
Well, I didn't start making it again for about 2 or 3 years, after I stopped doing any drugs. And I would say that, I can't say exactly how it changed, but obviously... the life that I led has informed my work in some way. That if I had just come straight out of art school and done work, it would have probably been a lot different than it is now.
That's interesting. How what are some of the ways you think your art was changed by that period?
I think I am drawn to subjects that are bordering on the unacceptable because I, for so long, lived an unacceptable life. I'm actually surprised that that I have a legitimate and socially redeeming function in life at this point, because for so long I didn't.
Do you feel comfortable in the gallery world?
I do, and I don't. I mean, I feel comfortable because I'm part of it, but there's always, there was the feeling that, I had one foot out and one foot in. And to this day, I'm not totally ensconced in the art world, But I think that's good. It makes me struggle harder.
Artist Andres Serrano is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Artist Andres Serrano is my guest. Lots of artists end up with descriptive labels in front of their names. Yours has been, since 1989, controversial or profane. But it's interesting, it hasn't been Latino. Do you know what I mean? People don't think of you as an artist who defines himself by his ethnic background.
Yeah, I suppose if I had to choose between one or the other, I'd choose the first. Because I have for many years, even though I have a Hispanic background, done the sort of work that is not labeled Latino. And to me, that's very gratifying because it's a lot more universal than that, I think. And, it's nice that I don't think of, they don't think of me when they want a token Latino in a show. That's nice. I can do without that.
Mm-hmm. You're interested in religious art, and what kind of art do you have in your home? Do you have much art in your house?
I've got a few photographs, one by George Platt Lines, who, without Lines, there wouldn't be any Robert Mapplethorpe. He did a lot of male nudes. My picture is one of a dance production that he did. I've got one of James Vandersee, probably the best-known black studio photographer in America. I've got a photograph by Edward Curtis that is actually a photograph and not a photogravure. I've got some photogravures by him also. And I also have a Baron von Gloden, he's a very curious figure in photography, certainly on the edge, who photographed all these young boys, dressing them as little Roman, boys at the turn of the century. And I also have a plaque by Jenny Holzer, a print by Ross Bleckner, and, one or two other things.
You told us before that you had a collection of crucifixes. Do you still have that collection?
I do, yes.
What else do you collect? What other kind of objects do you have in your house?
Mostly old things. I love antiques. I love to go, whenever I'm in a different city, even when I'm here, I always go to flea markets, and I like to buy old things. And, you know. That's, yeah.
I've read that you also have like a human brain in a jar.
Yeah, I've got two of them, actually. Yeah, two.
Is that from the morgue?
No, it's not. It's from a friend of mine who's got a store uptown, Maxillomandible.
What does your friend sell in the store?
He sells bones and skulls. You know, Henry used to work at the Museum of Natural History, and he's got a little store that is practically like a little museum in itself.
This might be too personal, so feel free not to answer it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'd read that your mother was hospitalized several times for psychosis.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever feel that your visions, the visions from which your art comes from, were psychotic or crazy?
Not at all. But, you know, when I was a kid, I was always terrified that people would find out that she had psychotic episodes. And I wanted to put as much distance between myself and any semblance of insanity. But it's funny, you know, at some point in my life, I guess because of, you know, because I am an artist and because I've, you know, due to the controversy, done so many lectures where I've had to accept who I am and publicly explain what I am, you know. And so the you know, insanity for me is no longer a threat, you know. I think we're all kind of crazy. It's okay.
Your show at the Paula Cooper Gallery is closing Sunday. What kind of feelings do you have when a show is about to close?
Actually, it closes Saturday.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you know, I get really sad, you know. I think it's called the, you know, post-exhibition depression.
Is the show going to be booked into another gallery, do you know?
The show is actually going to a museum in the south of France in March, and then to another museum in the north of France in May, and then possibly to another museum in Brussels.
Are people buying the photos? And I'm wondering if, like, individual collectors will hang it in their homes, or...
You know, a lot of people ask me that, and it's very simple. I mean, I've not asked Paula anything about sales because I don't want to know, you know. I know that, you know, when she gets paid, I get paid. So, you know, if I don't know the answer, then I can't tell you either.
So why don't you want to know?
Oh, because, you know, first of all, if I know, then I, you know, people will ask me, and then I have to say, yes, they're selling very well, and people look at you, you know, funny. And if you say, no, they're not selling, then people look at you funny again. So it's better not to say anything.
Andre Serrano, thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Artist Andre Serrano. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton is on the road trying to sell his economic proposals. Let's see how they're covering that on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We have our own Elizabeth Arnold on the road with him, and we'll check in with her from Chillicothe. We also have some folks out working the crowd and a report from Mara Liasson on the selling machine. And I did an interview today with the new Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, who was one of the people that sat around the table and tried to figure out what taxes to raise, what loopholes to close, what programs to cut. Robert has an interview with Milan Panic, who is the lame duck prime minister of Yugoslavia. And we have an interview with Fred Rogers. This is 25 Years in the Neighborhood.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Ten years ago, rock music was pulling itself out of the doldrums of the 70s. Here's rock historian Ed Ward to remind us of what we were hearing and seeing on the rock scene.
In 1983, there was the word, and the word was video. You either had one or you were nothing. And With videos being so much a part of the music scene today, it's odd to consider that only 10 years ago, they were still novelties with the power to make or break a career. And when I say make a career, I mean make a career.
She was more like a beauty queen from a movie scene. I said, don't mind, but what do you mean? I am the one to go dance on the floor and around. She said, I am the one who would dance on the floor and around.
Although Michael Jackson's album Thriller had been released in 1982, it wasn't until 1983 that the record company began to promote it heavily. This promotion included the famous alleged battle between CBS Records' Walter Yetnikoff and MTV, which supposedly refused to air the Billie Jean video because it wasn't rock and roll. MTV was being cocky. They knew the power they had, and they weren't above throwing it around. Fortunately, they lost the struggle, which is why the station is so well integrated today, under a completely different management. But video was just one more way of fragmenting an already fragmented music listenership. Ever since the programming patterns of AM and FM started diverging in the early 70s, American pop fans had also been grouping in smaller and smaller camps. So, while 1983 saw the video performers reaching ascendancy, it was also the heyday of a renaissance of American rock and roll. This early version of R.E.M.'s Radio Free Europe attracted the ear of IRS Records, the label Miles Copeland, brother of Stuart Copeland of the Police, owned. Soon, the Athens, Georgia Quartet had their recording budget raised so that they could make Murmur, their first album. In Minneapolis, another great American band had roared its way onto vinyl. Husker Du took their name from a Swedish board game, their sound from punk, and their pop sensibility from the Masters, and they'd go a long way artistically, if not commercially, by the time they broke up a few years later. Nor were they all that was happening in the Twin Cities.
I guess I should know, by the way you popped your car sideways, I don't wouldn't last. You're the kind of person that believes in making out once, love them and leave them fast. Guess I must be dumb. She had a pocket full of horses, Trojan and some of abuse. But it was Saturday night. I guess that makes it alright. You say, what have I got to lose? And honey, I say, big red Corvette. BB, you're much too fast. Big red Corvette. You need a love.
With his 1999 album, Prince fulfilled the promise he'd been hinting at all along, and rumor had it he was working on an autobiographical movie that would finally shed some light on his background. Prince and Michael Jackson so dominated black music in 1983 that discos were a hotbed of experimentation. New Order, the British band that had risen from the ashes of Joy Division, was working with Arthur Baker, the hip-hop wizard of New York, and everybody from David Bowie to Bruce Springsteen was having their stuff remixed by electro wizards like Baker. But some traditionalism remained in black music. It just didn't sell, that's all.
Love all. but it's taking me under. Since you're not here, oh, I feel so all alone. It's bitter when it's hard to get, but this hide and go seek, it's making me weak.
Womack and Womack released their classic Love Wars in 1983 and were ignored by all but the critics and the British, who've always had an ear for soul. The British, in fact, were leading us in fragmenting on the music scene as the post-punk era dissolved into endless cults of new romantics, neo-Celtic groups like Dexy's Midnight Runners, Soul Boys, and lots of folks with synthesizers. All of which meant that, like I said, if you had a video, you had a shot, and the Eurythmics were one of the groups that took it. But videos would soon fall into the hands of the dreadfully ordinary, and the blip of innovation that appeared on the screen in 1983 would soon recede, providing interesting music for the folks who wanted it, and entertainment for mass consumption to a generation that couldn't believe this stuff had ever been a statement.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Voblaitis. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was written by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Pockets of Hope, we talk with Reverend Johnny Ray Youngblood about how he revived a dying church in one of Brooklyn's poorest and most dangerous neighborhoods and turned it into a pillar of the community. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.